Travel writer William Dalrymple moved to India in 1989. Since then, he's been on hand to witness the explosion of the Indian economy and the cultural changes that have followed in its wake. In his new book called Nine Lives, Dalrymple goes in search of the sacred in modern India. He began by reading the story of two Baul singers, wandering minstrels, who struck up an unlikely friendship. Baals believe there is no afterlife, no God in heaven, only the God found in each man and woman. They practice esoteric teachings on breathing, sex, philosophy, and mysticism.
The Baals that I write about are Kanai, who's a blind Dalit from the lowest of the low in the Bengal social hierarchy, and his friend Debu, who was the son of a Brahmin, so from the very top of the Bengali village pyramid, if you like. And they became friends, having met one day by accident in a train carriage where they were both busking. And they stayed together and became sort of spiritual brothers wandering the roads of India. And I just read a short passage about the one time that they actually left each other's company. "There was only one time when I left him for an extended period," said Debu. "This was when I became obsessed with trying to live without food, like the saints and the yogis and the old stories. These saints controlled all their desires and so never ate. They lived on air alone. I wanted to find out if this was still possible, so I went off on my own and I found a wood apple tree in a forest near a pond. We believe these trees are very auspicious. I sat there in a loincloth and meditated for 2 years, eating less and less until I stopped eating altogether, taking a vow that no food would pass my lips until I reached my goal and achieved enlightenment. I don't know how I lived. I had matted dreadlocks down to my knees and I sat there not eating, not smoking, drinking nothing but water. I focused inwards, conserving my energies, and I sat there like that through 2 monsoons and 2 cold winters. I used to visit him, said Kanai. The villagers knew where he was and would lead me to him through the forest. They called him Bel Tala Babaji, the sadhu who sits under the wood apple tree. He was very thin and very weak. He hardly moved or talked, only very short sentences. I was very anxious that he wouldn't survive, and it pained me that he wouldn't eat. I bought him food, but he refused to eat it. He was very determined. I don't know what I attained with this penance, said Debu, but I know that my mind was at peace, as never before. My hair was matted, but the knots of my heart were untied. After a certain point, I stopped feeling hunger. I was at the end of desire, beyond the senses. It was then that I started hallucinating. I was no longer living inside my body. I was somewhere outside of myself in a state of ecstasy and rapture. I never felt anything like it before or since. And then one cold, starry night around the time of Makar Sankranti, I felt suddenly lost, as if my mind had finally detached itself from my body, like a bird flying high. It was Kanai who brought me back. What do you mean? Well, I was unaware of it, but there had been a terrible storm. Kanai had a premonition that I was in trouble and came over from Tarapit to see if I was all right. He arrived early in the morning with a group of villagers and found me up to my neck in a pool of mud, fast asleep. They all thought I was dead, and I suppose I almost was. Kanai brought me back to his house in Tarapit and nursed me back to health. The blind man saved the man who could see, said Kanai, chuckling to himself. Sometimes the mad and the sightless can understand things better and more clearly than the sane and the sighted. The blind, said Debu, are never deceived by appearances. Maybe, said Kanai, it is only those of us who have no eyes who can see through the lure of Maya and glimpse reality for what it is.
It's an extraordinary story. This is a story that is almost out of a different time. It's not 21st century Earth at all.
Yes, in part. Certainly the passage I read you could have been a Byzantine monk holed up in a hollow tree in the Levant in the 5th century, or some sort of Christian mystic like Julian of Norwich living in a hermitage in medieval England, or equally it could be from some Mahabharat or some ancient Indian folktale. But a lot of these lies continue. And what Nine Lives is about is the way that the ancient and the eternal, these extraordinary, profound philosophies that have developed in India, are increasingly being shot through with elements of modernity. The sadhus who wander the roads of India now wander past thundering trucks heading off to software centres and places where people are doing your bank accounts or booking your plane fares when you think you're actually talking down the street in New York at some back office in Bangalore. And it's not the urban centres that I've written about in this book, nor the unchanging India of the village. It is these places, which means most of India, which are suspended between modernity and tradition. In a halfway point, it's a report from the front line of the change that's overwhelming India in this extraordinary manner at the moment.
You know, this is what we hear about in this country, the India that is in competition with the United States, the India that is supposed to bypass the economy of America within the next 40 or 50 years. We hear about all those changes, and yet reading your nine lives and the multiple other lives that you can't include, there seems to be a huge swath of the population in India that isn't a part of that economy, the one that we read about in the papers every day.
Well, yes and no. I mean, at one level, you're quite correct. I think the Indian economic model is a very undemocratic one, despite the fact that India is a great, the world's largest democracy. China's development is being powered by mass economic empowerment. You know, there are huge industrial plants where large numbers of people are being employed, and that's the kind of basis of the economic miracle in China. In India, it's a far more elitist thing. There are these brilliant computer geeks and boffins and people speaking perfect English. A far smaller number of people are earning a far larger amount of money than is the case in China. So on one hand, you're right, it is a tiny proportion of the population that's engaged in this. On the other hand, modernity and the new India and the things that are changing touch the most surprising and remote and exotic corners of India. I mean, to give you one example, in the course of my research, I'd read an article by a professor of comparative religion about an extraordinary-sounding tantric who lived in Bengal. And this guy, who was called Tapan Goswami, was supposed to have the largest collection of skulls in India, and he used these skulls for his tantric magic. He would summon the spirits of the former inhabitants of the skulls and, as he believed, tame them with his magic. So I went and saw this guy, and we eventually found him, and it was like some scene from sort of, you know, Indiana Jones or some sort of fevered Orientalist fantasy from some Gothic novel. Tapan Goswami was there with his goat, which he was about to slaughter. The goat was tethered to a trident. Tapan was sharpening his sword in preparation for the sacrifice to the goddess. A mist was rising off the lake. And, you know, straight out of sort of, you know, Rider Haggard or something. And yet, you know, you talk to this guy and I said, is it true? And he said, absolutely, I've got this fantastic collection of skulls. And he chatted away a bit and then he sort of clammed up. And I said, go on, you can tell me, I won't tell anyone. And he said, well, you know, it's not you I'm worried about. It's my two boys. They're ophthalmologists in New Jersey. And they keep saying, Dad, you've got to stop going on about this black magic. It's getting a really bad name for us out here. Yeah. So even there, even in the kind of the furthest extremes of sort of Indiana Jones Orientalist fantasy, which, you know, it is there because it does exist in part. Even there, with the false skull feeders, you know, the Indian diaspora, the new India pops up. There's another time when I was walking in the Himalayas. High in the Himalayas. Gorgeous summer day, trekking up into the mountains. And this naked Naga sadhu came bounding up the hill, walking far faster and far fitter than I was. And he was almost completely naked, but for a blanket and a heavy trident that he was carrying on his shoulder, the symbol of Lord Shiva. And we fell in with each other, and I began talking to him. And it turned out he actually spoke English, which itself was a surprise, because you wouldn't expect a holy man necessarily to have any English. And he had really good English. And even more surprising, it turned out, in fact, he was an MBA. And he'd become a sadhu after a 10 years of selling white goods, fridges and kitchen appliances for a consumer electricals company called Kelvinator in Bombay. So, the old India is there, but it often is more surprising and more complex than one might imagine or indeed even wish.
You have watched with great intensity the lives of these people and of others. You talk about the coexistence now. Having met all of these people, having heard their stories, do you think that this kaleidoscopic version of religion and spirituality that's in India now will persist? Or is the modern world going to sweep it away? Will it wash away as the globe tightens, as everybody comes together?
I think there's several things to be said in answer to that. First of all, I think the globalization that people talk about can be hugely exaggerated. The world isn't flat, whatever Thomas Friedman says. While I'm now wearing a pair of Nikes and people will be wearing exactly the same pair of shoes in Saigon, in Singapore, in Siberia, the things going on in the minds of the people wearing those Nikes are still going to be as different as they ever have been. As something like 9/11 showed us, we may think we know the world. We may think we can go on our laptop and look at Google Earth and see a street in Afghanistan as easily as we can see a street in New York. But the reality is that we don't know the world. There are huge areas of the world we don't understand at all. But is this all going to die out? The answer is that some forms are dying out. The small gods in the villages are giving way to the national gods. In the same way, in Islam, the small Sufi shrines which dot South Asia, and the common people go and pray at the saint shrine, they tie a thread through a lattice and ask for a child or a job for the man or exam results for the children or whatever it is. These are giving way to, in Islam, to a more sort of homogenized, textual, reformed Islam. Often of a more sort of Wahhabi nature, more puritanical nature, rather like Reformation Christianity replacing the Catholicism of the Middle Ages. And on the other hand, there are other religious groupings that I write about. I went to the Kanduli Mela, which is the big annual gathering of the Baals. And it makes sort of Woodstock look like a Rotarian's dinner. There's 25,000 tantrics all singing, smoking dope and screeching at each other at the same time. It's a fabulous fair. Yeah. And that seemed this year to be busier than it's ever been. And more and more tantric screeching than ever before.
William Dalrymple is the author of Nine Lives, In Search of the Sacred in Modern India.